You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. I'm very happy to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Sarah Solovich. She's executive editor of Searchlight New Mexico, an investigative journalism organization covering the whole state of New Mexico. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you. You're doing so many great stories, and one of them that I thought was really important to talk about today, because we do a lot on this program about democracy.
Yeah.
And about, you know, how to make sure that people are enfranchised in one way or another. And a recent article in Searchlight was about the census, and specifically the census in New Mexico. And the census, of course, is one of those things that kind of falls into the category of, this seems kind of boring and bureaucratic, but it's incredibly important. The U.S. Constitution mandates that we count our population every 10 years. What are the particular challenges of doing that counting here in New Mexico?
Well, the problem in New Mexico is that we have these vast rural areas combined with people who are traditionally vulnerable to undercount. It's a very unique set of demographics. We've got a large Native American and Hispanic population. And of course, we have these high poverty rates. And so these three factors all combine to really create a perfect storm. So in 2000, the undercount in just New Mexico was almost 2%. That's about 35,000 people or more. That's the fourth highest undercount of any state in the country. Then in 2010, they brought it down really significantly because of this huge, massive effort in the state and the federal and local governments to address it. And they actually identified 100,000 housing units that hadn't made it to the Census Bureau's address list. But at this point, there's this fear that, you know, because of funding problems, because of this whole citizenship question that the feds have introduced, that they're insisting upon, that this is going to create a much bigger problem for us going forward.
How do we know when there's an undercount?
Wow, that's a good question. How do we know? Well, we know it certainly with individuals. For instance, we know that in the Native American population, there has been, I think there's something like 10 million Native Americans in the entire country. We know that they are undercounted in really huge numbers. Something like a million of them they'll tell you themselves. When our reporter went out to the Navajo Nation to write to report on this story, he just went from he had a guide, somebody who kind of took him around, but he talked to many, many people who said that their families had never been counted during the census. So some of it is certainly anecdotal, but also studies have confirmed that. The census itself tells us that something like 6% of all Native Americans are never counted, that a huge number of Hispanics aren't counted, that a lot of children, especially children who grow up in really poor parts of the state here in New Mexico and around the country, are never counted. It's a huge problem.
Is the census a sample, or is it really supposed to go to every single household?
It is supposed to count every person in the country.
So everybody gets a form kind of thing?
Every household gets a form.
Yeah.
And it's not supposed to count just citizens or legal residents. It is supposed to count absolutely everything. And it was set up, it's kind of the gold standard of census taking in the entire world, not just the United States. Everybody kind of just treats it with good cause as this incredibly important act that we embark upon every 10 years. And it doesn't just, certainly it affects, you know, our politics, the number of representatives who go to Congress, right? It affects redistricting, which is about to go into place in 2021. So that's going to all hinge on the census. But it also affects things like how businesses decide to invest in certain places. They look at where populations are moving and what exists, the education levels, all kinds of things. But it's all based on the census. The surveys that government researchers do are based on the census. And then, of course, there's the hundreds of federal programs that use the census to distribute and allocate funds around the country. And that's where it's really going to hurt us deeply if we have an undercount.
I was thinking, when I was thinking about the census, I mean, in the old days, there would be some probably gentlemen who went from one house to the next and however that went. Now we have so many tools like Google Earth and so many high-tech tools. But as you wrote in this article, we see that, for example, the Navajo guy that you wrote about, his house isn't even on Google Maps. And a lot of the houses in the Navajo Nation and other places as well are on streets that don't really have names and so they don't have proper mailing addresses.
There's no numbers. There's no road names. These people get all their mail and their identity is in a P.O. box. And the census will not go to a P.O. box. So in the past, you've had these enumerators go out and collect, going door to door. Certainly, they've never done it or have done it very poorly on the Navajo Nation. But they, you know, they've done that around the country and in all kinds of small towns and rural areas. Now the census is going online. You will be able to, if you want, respond to it, do your survey by phone or by mail. But people are going to be really encouraged to do it via the internet. Well, the problem, especially, it's not just among Native Americans, but the problem for all of New Mexico is that only like 67% of people in this state have broadband access to the internet. So that means a third of all New Mexicans don't have access. That's hundreds of thousands of people who are not going to be counted or are potentially at risk of not being counted. And so they'll go out, you know, they'll have these Google Maps. It's not even Google Maps. I think it's some kind of proprietary device that the Census Bureau has devised. It's some kind of a phone app. And the enumerators will go out and try to contact and send them the data back to the Census Bureau's own computers. But the chance that they're going to be able to do so is kind of slim for a large percentage of people.
And so Indian people are uncounted and rural people as well?
A lot of rural people are uncounted. The people in the colonias, for instance, I mean, they face a lot of the same problems of, you know, they're not online. They live off the grid, basically. They are not going to be, you know, they're just not easily countable. We're one of the hardest, if not the hardest, to count states in the country.
And we're big and sprawling. And so whereas in a city or in a suburb, the enumerator doesn't have very far to drive.
Yeah. So in this case, like in a rural state like ours, if the enumerator drives out and finds that nobody's home, that's where the cost comes in to the federal government for this census tract. So they're trying to eliminate those costs of like those wasted trips. But that's been part of the problem, compounded with the fact that the Trump administration has really refused or declined to give a lot of extra money that they've been asking for. It's a problem. We're facing a problem.
Not to mention that there is this controversial citizenship question that they want to put in. How do you think that would affect New Mexico?
Well, one of our reporters, Ed Williams, went down to the border and spent time just talking to people and going to kind of ad hoc classes that are run by advocacy organizations and libraries and other places, trying to assure people that they're not going to be put at risk if they answer the question yes or no, and or just be counted, period. And he found that people were really very reluctant to count. And I think that most people, I spoke with someone on one of the advisory committees to the census, and she said that, you know, we're already, you know, we've lost a lot of trust and that there's a question about what really a true count will get.
I mean, I'm just kind of trying to imagine it. I mean, okay, the census is looking at broadband, but how do they have everybody's emails, and how could they possibly link an email to an address? I mean, that's a huge issue. And are there privacy concerns? I mean, obviously they want to count everybody, but then, okay, you get something in the mail. How many people trust the government and are going to return it? Even people who are citizens and whose addresses are valid. And so it just seems like there's so many issues, even when things potentially could go well.
Yes, it's an experiment in the making. I don't really, you know, it's questionable. In fact, what's interesting is that the Census Bureau had been planning to do test runs, which is something that they've done in the past. They were going to do test runs in three different locations, the state of Washington, I think Virginia, West Virginia, and Rhode Island, like one county in Rhode Island, Providence. And they, at the last minute, decided, because of funding problems, that they couldn't afford to do this. So they decided to just limit it to one, to Rhode Island. And they're just on the verge of finishing it, or have just finished it right now. But there are real concerns about how that went. And in fact, I think there was a press conference a few weeks ago in which the mayor of Providence stood up and said that he had grave concerns about, you know, what the results were. And I mean, and they're only doing this in one place.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's interesting, too, because here in New Mexico, and as you say, all across the country where Native Americans are concerned, there is the danger of, or the reality of, serious undercounts. But there's also something that came out in the Searchlight pieces, namely that there are a whole bunch of counting traditions in indigenous communities. And yeah, there's now an indigenous data project.
Yeah, wasn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I found that fascinating. There are many projects of this sort by tribes all around the country. And in fact, it didn't even begin in the U.S. It started among First Nations in Canada and the Maori in New Zealand. But apparently this just goes back hundreds, if not thousands of years, to tribes counting all kinds of things, you know, the herd, deaths, marriages, births. I mean, they just are, as it was told to me, the original counters. And so now they've tried to reclaim this. Various tribes around the U.S. are doing this. And there's an organization, an office at the University of Arizona, which is working with tribal leaders and citizens, kind of teaching them how to do it. And so it's just becoming a kind of, you know, like from the ground up project. And of course, they're coming up with numbers that totally challenge what the Census Bureau is finding. They're finding that the statistics, you know, they're really disputing what the census is finding at this point.
So these are nationwide and, as you say, worldwide data projects. One of them is called the U.S. Indigenous Data Sovereignty Network.
Yeah.
So they come up with different numbers. Is there a mechanism whereby they can challenge the U.S. Census? Do we know? Has that happened yet?
The way it was described to me was that most of their census taking is for their own private purposes. Like in some cases, they may be counting sacred sites on their land, which they will not share.
Right.
It is not intended for dissemination the way all the, you know, our census, you know, it's all about transparency and sharing of data. But that is not the case here at all. In many cases, people are just closing off and saying, this is for our information only. But then, of course, there's other, like the, you know, straight on numbers that they will want to share. And there is also a concern with the lack of trust and the problems going forward with the census overall, not just Native Americans, but that there could be many lawsuits that emerge from this census.
Very interesting. So let's talk specifically about New Mexico, because as you said before, there's a lot at stake in New Mexico if the numbers are wrong, even by 1 or 2 percentage points.
Yeah, yeah. For every New Mexican not counted, we lost almost $3,000 for each of 10 years. And that was just in the last, was that the last census? I think that was the 2010 census. Anyway, that's for a 1% undercount. So that's more than $600 million.
Of federal money?
Yeah, that we don't get. And we rely on this money for all our Medicaid, basically, for our Housing 8 vouchers, for SNAP, our nutrition programs, for all kinds of programs, education grants, community development block grants, and then transportation and infrastructure. So this is incredibly critical to New Mexico as a whole.
And of course, the most vulnerable people are in the hardest to count areas, and they get hit hardest by cutbacks in education and health and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's going to affect the redistricting, the number of representatives that they're going to be able to send to Congress, right? And the dollars that we get for Medicaid and food stamps and education, which, considering that we now have to address our education problems in light of this lawsuit, that adds kind of further insult to injury.
Talk just a little bit about that lawsuit. Give us the context.
So New Mexico was sued by a number of organizations a couple years ago for violating the civil rights of at-risk students around the state. And the decision was just made maybe 3 weeks ago by the judge, Sarah Singleton, who ruled that, in fact, yes, New Mexico has violated and they have to, it has to correct. It has to provide services, and it doesn't even matter whether the state claims that it doesn't have the money to do so or not. Not having funds is not an excuse for violating civil rights and not providing a basic education to its citizens, to its students. So this is going to be a pretty costly lawsuit. It's really considered a landmark decision, and it has already cast a huge controversy within the state. Everybody in education circles are talking about it and wondering how the state is going to address it and looking at what we're going to do going forward.
And meanwhile, talking about the census, if the residents of the state were counted properly, part of the money it's going to cost to address that lawsuit could come from available dollars, which we'd be basically leaving on the table if we're not counting our citizens.
Certainly for special ed. That's going to be incredibly important. And special ed was a big piece of the lawsuit. So saying that we don't have the dollars for special ed when a lot of that comes from the state. Also, at a lot of the at-risk students, in fact, in the lawsuit itself, came from the reservations and Hispanic groups.
Is it in anybody's interest? I mean, what are the politics of this? Is it in anybody's interest for a population to be undercounted?
You know, it's interesting. That's happened. I think we can look to the past and use the past as an example for going forward. Like, for instance, as the census was first imagined, it was really only white people who were counted. And I think slaves were counted like as a half.
Three-fifths.
So like going back, you know, a couple hundred years. And the people who were taxed as a whole were citizens who are taxed, right? And so it was clear, like, the Indians weren't taxed. They were never intended to be taxed, and so they were never counted. And I think that was also actually intentional, because obviously if you had counted them, it would have been very clear that the land wasn't open. It was occupied. There
right.
were people here, and it would have been an admission that the West wasn't just there for the taking, that manifest destiny was not something that you could argue logically. And so keeping the Indians undercounted served the nation and its intent to move west very clearly.
And also, having fairly recently fought a revolution based on a number of slogans, including no taxation without representation, if you're going to tax people, they have to be represented. And that way they could keep Native people unrepresented.
Yeah, they work kind of together.
Yeah. So all of this is what's happening and the implications for the census in New Mexico. There are also national concerns where the census is concerned. For example, I was reading an article where they were saying that there are real concerns about the possibility of hacking the census. This could be done by a foreign power or really by anybody who had some interest in seeing to it that the numbers are falsified. I mean, especially given the 2016 election, that's a real concern.
You know, that's something we didn't write about at all, honestly, but I think that any time that you restrict any kind of count, whether it's the vote or the census, to a purely digital recording and you don't have a paper trail, that becomes a real concern, doesn't it? It's just not easily tracked.
Right. So we talked about this a little bit with respect to Indian country, but do individual states, like let's say the state of New Mexico determines that there's been a state undercount. Let's say the governor of New Mexico has some mechanism. Can we do anything?
We've never done anything in the past, and we have recognized and known, it's been well documented, that the undercount has existed in previous years, these decennial censuses, as they call them. And no, nothing has ever been successfully challenged, to my knowledge.
Very interesting. So this is a big deal. It's coming up in 2020. Meanwhile, Searchlight New Mexico is focusing its energies. All the articles in one way or another touch on the question of child well-being in the state of New Mexico. And this, although you don't necessarily immediately think of children when you think of the census, it's still a big deal.
You know, we chose child well-being as a way of looking at the state of New Mexico through kind of one prism. It just provided a great window for looking at the state as a whole. And it has continued to really pay off in just these vast ways. You can almost look at any issue, whether it's the brain drain or the economy or the environment and certainly education and early childhood education and poverty. Everything ultimately funnels down to this issue of our children and the future that we're providing them and how we prepare them to take their place in the world that we're going to leave for them. And so there's nothing that exists independent of that. It's all of a piece.
Searchlight New Mexico as an organization has been around for over a year. You've been publishing for a little more than 6 months, and you've been publishing in virtually every newspaper in the state.
Yeah.
How's that going?
That's wonderful. That's one of my great prides. Yeah. We have agreements, media agreements, with every newspaper in New Mexico, with KOAT-TV in Albuquerque, with multiple radio stations. And so we feel that we're really blanketing and providing kind of our mission of exposing and writing and looking at child well-being, but also providing solutions and being really solution-based, because we do not want to simply criticize. We want to look at answers, whether they're right here in New Mexico or whether they exist outside the state. We've also recently signed an agreement with the Washington Post as a media partner. They'll be publishing certain stories of ours that really resonate for them, that they're really interested in, and speak to kind of the national interest in New Mexico when those stories arise. And also, we've just signed an agreement with a large radio station in northern Mexico called Mega, M-E-G-A. It beams to hundreds of thousands of listeners across northern Mexico, but also into southern New Mexico and southern Texas. And two of our reporters, Lauren Villagran and Ed Williams, who are both bilingual, will be appearing on those on that show on a weekly basis and talking about our stories and reaching hundreds of thousands of Spanish-speaking listeners. That's also quite an accomplishment.
That's huge. I mean, the Washington Post. So now Searchlight New Mexico, based here in our humble little town, or maybe not so humble.
Not so humble.
based here in Santa Fe, and your offices are the offices of the Santa Fe New Mexican, is going to have a huge reach. And what kind of feedback are you getting from readers and listeners?
It's almost all very positive. I don't think I've ever lived anywhere, and I've lived all over the country, where there has just been such an openness and a thirst for really good journalism and an appreciation for what we're doing. I just routinely hear it. When I mean, there are people who haven't heard of us, unfortunately, but I think they will as another half year of reporting and our stories continue to go out. It's kind of amazing. It's only been half a year since we launched our first story.
And I think what's tricky is you've got newspapers all over the state, including the Santa Fe New Mexican, who are publishing the stories. People read them. They might not know that it's a Searchlight story.
That's right. Yeah. Our banner does. It's included, I think, every time it runs. That's the agreement. However, people don't notice that. They don't look at bylines. They don't really notice the banner. And so a lot of times they'll see a story, and what we'll hear from an editor at one of our many partner newspapers, they'll hear the response to the story and they'll pass it on to us. But oftentimes we don't hear, because people don't, they don't make the connection that it's Searchlight New Mexico. And you know, often they'll say, Searchlight New Mexico, who is that? We haven't heard of that one.
And it's a nonprofit organization, so of course you are always looking for funding, and people can donate if they wish.
Yes, thank you very much. It's searchlightnm.com, and we welcome funding. We're very eager to kind of extend our reach and make new friends and have a real local base of support. That's instrumental.
And one of the nice things also about searchlightnm.com is you've got some great photography going on. That's a big part of it. I mean, yeah, the stories are very information rich, but there's also the kind of photography where you really get to see the state of New Mexico and its inhabitants in a beautiful way.
We've been really lucky, and I can't take any credit for that. But when I first arrived here, I realized that I had this great gift in Don Usner, this master photographer, in my opinion, who is from New Mexico. And when he takes photographs of it, you just see the love of the state that comes through. And I think it does best in his black and white photography, which is what we really have, I think, come to just, you know, kind of throw our bets with. Our partners typically want color, and that's fine. We can provide color. But it's those black and white photos that are just so rich and haunting and really depict the loneliness and the beauty and just and talk about the enchantment of New Mexico.
Sarah Solovich is executive editor of Searchlight New Mexico. Once again, they're on the web at searchlightnm.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Mary Charlotte. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.